tinnitus out of his ears. His iPhone rang, and as usual, there was no caller ID because his clientele preferred anonymity. He took the call.
Yeah?
She said, "Hardly more than a week since I saw you. I must be the best customer you have." Sexy as she was, he knew her voice as much from dreams as from the times she'd done business with him face to face. He said,
"You're so big now, maybe I shouldn't risk doing any more business with you."
"Like I'm gonna believe your balls fell off. I'm only a few hundred miles away. I'd have heard them hit the ground." He laughed.
"Bonita chica. Maybe yours are bigger than mine."
"I need a motorhome. I'm sure you've fitted them out before with cute little hard-to-find compartments."
"Could be. I got a couple right now."
"Gas, not a diesel pusher. 36 to 40 feet.
"I got a Tiffin Allegro 36. Total refit. Custom paint. Nobody ever knew her would know her now. She's so pretty."
She told him the size of the custom storage spaces she needed. She also specified a pistol that she required. He said,
"Doable on both counts."
"I need everything by late tomorrow morning."
"Shit, no."
"I'll pay a premium."
"Tiffin Allegro 36-footer, new off the showroom floor, would cost you $180,000.
"Like you bought it right off the showroom floor. What was your wholesale price, $4,000 to some booster?"
"Plus, there's the work you want done overnight."
"Ricky, Ricky, Ricky, will you pretend you have to charge sales tax? Listen, one thing you do need to add to the total is delivery."
"You think I'm Amazon or something?"
"You know the address near Palm Springs. You once recommended the man there to me, but I never needed him until now." Enrique's nephew, Ferrante, operated a legit business in Indio, customizing limousines, high-end SUVs, and other vehicles, not only making them more luxurious than the original manufacturers had made them, but also armoring them and installing bullet-resistant glass and run-flat tires for wealthy people who watched the world grow darker and heard lethal violence justified from podium to pulpit. In addition, as insurance against another government screw-up that would sink the economy yet again and devastate his customizing business, Ferrante dealt in illegal arms from a secret basement under one of his factories. Because his mother, Josefina, Enrique's sister, had for some reason raised the boy in the church, he would not sell weapons to criminals, only to the upstanding citizens who purchased his armored vehicles, titans of industry and banking and social media companies, and probably to a rogue FBI agent who was maybe more righteous than the people who accused her of treason. "I assume," Jane Hawk said, "your contact there will let your vehicle on his lot and let me prepare for a trip I have to make."
"We're tight. But I have to say, he's a weird duck. He does mass daily. Always saying his rosary like some old abuela who wears a mantilla even in the shower. He's got this blood obsession."
"Blood obsession?"
"You meet him, you'll see. But he's not loco. He's smart. He knows how the world works. I guarantee you can do your meet there."
"I'm assuming the Tiffin Allegro can tow an SUV?"
"What SUV you want it to tow?"
she told him. "So how much will you rob me for?" He stood thinking, watching the insects leap, watching a sudden flock of crows cackle down out of the sun, snaring the bugs in mid-jump, glossy black wings thrashing the golden grass and fireweed, the singing of the grasshoppers now like thin screams.
$120,000 on delivery. You got that much?"
"Yeah, but you're a true bandit, Ricky."
"There's a way I could let you have it for 70.
"What way is that?"
"Take a break from what you're doing. Stay a month with me."
"A month with you, Ricky? I'd be used up, worn out, no good for anything anymore."
"I'd be gentle. You'd be surprised."
"I know you'd be gentle. You're chivalrous. But I'm a widow, you know, and figuratively speaking, I'm wearing black.
I forgot the whole widow thing for a minute. My apologies.
Accepted. And don't worry about the 120. It's all in clean bills. Nobody's looking for it.
I don't worry about you, he said. I know you won't screw me. Not that way. And I guess not any other way.
Business and romance never mix anyway, she said.
Guy who had this operation before me, Enrique said, hooked up with this lady customer, ended up with his head cut off.
There you go. Let's keep our heads, Ricky. She terminated the call. Up there at the barn in which Enrique had his office, at a door that couldn't be seen from the highway, Danny and Tia were dumping a dead guy in the open cargo bed of a mule, a nice little electric vehicle that was useful for a variety of tasks. Chapter 20. The shadows of the parking lot lampposts sheathed at noon, now slowly extending west across the truck stop blacktop, like swords drawn to defend against the dragon growl of diesel engines. Enrique DeSoto had come to Jane Hawk's attention when she had tracked down Marcus Paul Hedzman, a serial killer who'd stolen a car from Enrique. The FBI had too few agents and too many cases to care about the small beer DeSoto operation. Hedzman was the game. Likewise, over in the Department of Justice, prosecutorial overload required a triage approach to selecting which criminals to proceed against. Jane had first purchased a Ford Escape from Ricky shortly after she went on the run. She'd given him the impression that the law had never bothered him because she'd shredded the file on him, which was neither true nor necessary. Ricky was macho enough to convince himself that a good-looking FBI agent would be so drawn to him that she'd cut off the hands of justice to keep them from seizing him. One of the most dispiriting things about her current situation was the need to work with criminals whom she would have liked to put behind bars. There were degrees of evil, however, and in these dark times, which seemed to darkle deeper every day, absolute purity of action ensured defeat. The armies of virtue were either too few in number or too cowed by the volume of political hatred to be counted upon. When bargaining with lesser evils to obtain what was necessary to wage war against evil in the upper case, she'd keep her footing if she was always alert to the stain it left on her, if she remained aware of the need for contrition, and if she would, supposing that she lived, eventually bring to justice those like Ricky DeSoto with whom she'd had to traffic. Now, in a remote corner of the big parking lot, with the Explorer Sport shielding her from observation by those coming and going from the truck stop, she knelt on the blacktop and used a hammer to pound a screwdriver into the charging port of the burner phone, destroying the battery and, with it, the identifier by which the phone might be tracked. She smashed the screen and broke open the casing, intending to cross the 50 yards of weedy field and throw the debris into the ravine toward which the land sloped. In this age when every phone and computer and laptop and every car with a GPS and even every high-tech wristwatch was a beacon by which you could be tracked, measured paranoia was essential to survival. If the first call she made was to any person who might conceivably be a target of law enforcement, she discarded her burner after a single use. Luther Tillman's location was unknown to all authorities, and Bernie Rigowitz was a most unlikely subject for surveillance. However, once she had spoken to Enrique DeSoto, she needed to dispose of the phone, lest someone monitoring him might learn its identifier code and even now be committing the nation's every resource to locate and apprehend her. Recently, she had destroyed a lot of disposable phones. Of course, if these days Enrique was in fact a hot target of one law enforcement agency or another, simply placing the order for the motorhome had all but ensured Jane's destruction. When the Tiffin Allegro 36 showed up in Indio, driven by one of Ricky's people, soon thereafter a demon horde of SWAT-geared Arcadians would storm the place. However, She had no choice but to trust that Ricky had taken adequate steps to mask his true identity when he'd bought the smartphone and contracted with a telecom company. She picked up the broken burner and rose to her feet and saw the guy first from the corner of her eye. He was coming through the bristled field from the direction of the oaks and ravine, moving fast, a shotgun raised and ready. Chapter 21. From his rover, through binoculars, Ivan Petro watches Jane Hawk exit the truck stop diner with a bag of takeout and a tall drink container. Spine straight, shoulders back, with the grace and confidence of a born athlete, she exhibits none of the furtiveness or wariness that might mark her as a fugitive. The pixie-cut wig is different from the shaggy black number she wore the previous night, but neither the hair nor the horn-rimmed glasses can conceal her essential Jane-ness. She returns to the Explorer and drives as far from the bustling business as the pavement allows and parks next to an open field. After Ivan repositions his SUV, he uses the binoculars again, pulls her close, and sees that she is eating lunch. She has put down the window. A soft breeze stirs her hair, suggesting that she has also put down the front window on the passenger side. He watches her, thinking. When she seems to be talking on a cell phone, he decides he better seize this opportunity. His all-wheel drive vehicle has a special GPS developed by the NSA, which offers displays not only of highways, roads, and streets, but also off-road topography in considerable detail. Because Jane has chosen to have lunch in the most remote corner of the property, Ivan realizes that a way exists to get close to her without calling attention to his Range Rover or himself. He leaves the truck stop not by its exit lane, but overland. Her Explorer faces due east. He passes behind her, 100 yards to the west. She can see him, if at all, only in the rearview mirror. He crosses the 50 yards of open land and drives between two live oaks under massive anaconda limbs of hardened sinuosity. He negotiates a long slope, a carpet of beetle-shaped leaves crunching under the tires, scaring squirrels up tree trunks, and descends into a realm of gothic shadows, the dark ground patterned by a scattering of sunlight configured by the branches and leaves overhead. At the bottom of the glen, he drives east until the blinking indicators on the GPS display, red for the Explorer, green for his rover, are parallel, whereupon he stops and switches off the engine. The slope to the north is maybe 200 feet long, but not too steep to climb. When he gets to the top, there will be about a 50-yard length of open ground between him and the Explorer. The pistol he's carrying is a Colt 45, but he doesn't want to take her down with that. He needs to capture her, not kill her, if he's going to learn where to find her child and where she's stashed the evidence that might convict some Arcadians. He gets out of the rover and lifts the tailgate. He zippers open a shotgun case and removes a wireless Taser XREP 12-gauge. This pump-action weapon provides a 5-round magazine and fires an extended-range electronic projectile that weighs less than an ounce, but delivers a 20-second, 500-volt shock. A classic Taser arcs up to 50,000 volts, but this slug does more with less, because the waveform is precisely shaped to match the electric signals in the human nervous system. The 4 barbed electrodes on the nose of the slug hook to skin or clothes, causing intense pain and muscle paralysis, incapacitating the target with little chance of permanent injury and hardly any risk of death. With her vehicle screening the assault from those at the truck stop, he needs to disable her only long enough to cuff her wrists and ankles and then administer chloroform with an inhaler. Ivan is at least 100 pounds heavier than she is. Slabs of muscle, he can easily carry her into the trees, and then either continue carrying her or drag her down the slope to the Range Rover. He ascends through crackling drifts of dead leaves. The ground is blanketed in a camouflage of oak shadows and glimmering shapes of sunlight. It would be easy to put a foot wrong and sprain an ankle. He takes longer to reach the crest than he expected. The delay works to his advantage. When he arrives at the rim of the glen and shelters among the last trees, he sees that he needn't worry about the passenger side window being open to allow a clear shot at Jane in the driver's seat. She's out of the SUV, kneeling on the blacktop, hammering what might be a disposable phone. Although a standard taser with wires can disable a target up to 35 feet, the XREP 12 gauge has an effective range of 100 feet. He is about half again that distance from the woman and needs to close the gap before he fires. When he steps out of the cover of the trees, there is a danger that she will see him, even as distracted as she is by the phone. The field before him bristles with weeds and parched ribbon grass, but he will make little noise forging through it. He moves fast, holding the gun with both hands, a few inches above his waist, ready to bring it up and halt and tag her with the laser sight before he fires. The powder in an XREP round is less than in a standard shell. The slug, which is comparatively light, never achieves a velocity that will kill or seriously injure. The slug is a wonder of miniaturization. Three fins that deploy when it leaves the muzzle of the shotgun, enabling it to spin to stay on target. Circuitry nestled inside shock-absorbing plastic. A microprocessor that commands a voltage capacitor to fire while also modulating the shape, intensity, and duration of the current. Two tiny lithium batteries to power the microprocessor and provide the disabling electrical charge. A transformer to convert battery energy to stunning effect. He is maybe 120 feet from her, hasn't yet drawn her attention, and decides to close to 80 just to be sure to drop her with the first round. Then, she sees him. Chapter 22. Upon glimpsing the man in her peripheral vision, Jane might have dropped the hammer and gone for the heckler in her shoulder rig, but intuition inspired her instead to throw the hammer as she pivoted toward her assailant. He wasn't holding the weapon as if he expected a hard recoil. The sound of the shot wasn't as loud as it ought to be, and Jane knew at once that this was a Taser XREP. Fractions of a second mattered now. When she moved to throw the hammer, the laser dot on her breast had been displaced to her left arm, but the shooter had squeezed the trigger just then as the hammer left her hand. Instantly, she began to shrug off the sport coat. On impact, four electrified barbs on the nose of the projectile hooked the coat sleeve near the shoulder, instead of piercing her thin t-shirt over her breasts, where it would have administered a disabling shock. Even as the projectile's chassis separated from its nose to dangle on a copper wire, exactly as it was designed to do, Jane cried out at the initial and smaller, localized shock to her left biceps, conveyed through her clothing. But the satin-lined sleeves were already sliding off her arms. Nearly all people, when hit, instinctively grabbed the dangling wire, which was called the hand trap, to tear out the barbs that were delivering the painful localized shock. But if she grasped the live wire, her hand would contract involuntarily. Clenching the wire tightly, unable to let go, she would receive a much bigger shock as electricity flowed through her body. She would spasm, fall, lie paralyzed for 20 seconds, and be disoriented thereafter. If she didn't grip the wire, six longer barbs would pop through the fabric of her sleeve and deliver the disabling shock anyway. Half a second after the nose barbs hooked her coat, even as the chassis of the projectile was separating from the nose to offer the live wire, her right arm was free. As her left arm slipped out of that sleeve, a brief, hellish current stung her fingers, but the garment puddled to the ground, sparing her from the full power of the initial shock. Although she couldn't feel the laser dot on her body, she knew her assailant must be squeezing off another round. She dropped as she drew the heckler. The second projectile shattered against the explorer, and she rolled toward the front bumper. Chapter 23. This hateful bitch, this self-righteous, self-appointed, save-the-world bitch, this counter-revolutionary pig has the reflexes of a cat, a damn hyperactive cat. She's twisting away from the laser dot and shrugging out of the coat even as Ivan is pulling the trigger, so just for insurance, he at once fires again. He's not thinking about the hammer. It's a wild pitch meant to distract him, and Ivan Petro won't be distracted. Hell if he will. He's focused on her. He squeezes off a third round. Her aim is almost as good as her reflexes. The tumbling hammer, like some instrument in an Olympic event, arcs high and spins down to strike him just as he fires for the third time. It clips his left hand, with which he holds the slide handle that chambers each round. The pain brings with it an instant numbness, so that he can't keep a grip on the shotgun with his left hand, and he can't operate it with only his right. Two rounds remain in the taser, useless to him for the moment. The bitch is on the ground, a difficult, almost impossible target from this distance, when he has only one good hand. She rolls, and then squirms along the blacktop toward the front of the explorer, seeking partial cover from which she can rise into a genuflection and open fire. She's seconds from using him for target practice. He has no prospect of cover in this open field, only below-the-knee weeds and ribbon grass. Instead of drawing his pistol, he throws down the taser 12-gauge and runs in a crouch toward the oaks. Chapter 24. A cloud of midges bestirred from the grass, circling around her head like some crown of damnation predictive of imminent death, the sun seeming much hotter than it was a moment earlier, and yet a thin, cold sweat on the nape of her neck. The low-velocity rounds from the taser 12-gauge wouldn't have drawn the attention of anyone at the distant truck stop, not with the growl of half a dozen 18-wheelers coming and going at any one time. The crack of the heckler, however, might penetrate the truck drone and alert someone. Anyway, she didn't dare risk killing the bastard. She needed to take him down, get some answers from him. How did he find her? Was there a transponder on her explorer? If so, who else knew about it? How many others were coming? Holstering the pistol, she scrambled to her feet, stomped on the chassis of the taser projectile that was attached to her sport coat and trailing at the end of the copper wire. She crushed it and stomped again, separating the nose from the wire, protected by the rubber soles of her sneakers. She snatched up the coat, shook it, casting off the debris, and sprinted after her attacker. He was a big bull on 2 feet, a minotaur without a labyrinth. She needed to avoid getting close-up physical with him and take him by surprise instead. She thought the hammer had struck him, might have done some damage, which was why he'd cast aside the taser 12-gauge and fled. Fast for his size, with a substantial head start, he would reach the cover of the trees well before she did. If she plunged into the woodlet in his wake, she'd likely plunge as well into a bullet. She hesitated at the dropped taser shotgun, but then snatched it up to be sure he didn't return for it. She angled west of him and demanded more speed of herself and hoped that she made the tree line before he dared to stop, turn, and see where she had gone. After the bright sun, the sudden shadows pooling in the broad glen seemed to have substance, a palpable darkness that was cool on her skin and a pressure on her eyes, its weight imposing a stillness in the oak grove and stifling all sound except her breathing. She put down the taser 12-gauge and slipped her arms into the sleeves of her coat and stood with her back to a massive tree trunk. She drew the heckler and held it in both hands, arms close to her breast, muzzle directed toward the crosswork of layered limbs above, her stalker somewhere behind her, 50 or 60 feet to the east. Waiting for her wide-open eyes to become dark-adapted, striving to quiet her breathing, she listened intently, but still heard only the distant Peterbilts and Macs, nothing nearby. The trucks were so far away that, instead of growling, they made a throaty, threatening purr, as if they were massive saber-toothed tigers that had crossed a gulf of time to hunt long after the extinction of their species. Alert for any sound from her stalker, she knew that he likewise listened for the smallest revelation of her position. Cautiously, she leaned away from the tree and turned her head to look around it. If the canopy of oaks hadn't allowed a brace of sun spears to stab down on the Black Range Rover, she might not have seen it at the bottom of the glen, about 60 feet to the east and south of where she'd parked her explorer. The vehicle waited, glossy dark and as ominous as a hearse, shapes of sunlight in its windows like the pale, luminous faces of the long departed. The lower half of the south wall of the glen, rising beyond the Range Rover, lay under a heavy thatching of branches. Those shadows were unrelieved. She liked those shadows, the cover they offered. He would avoid the vehicle, figuring that she'd expect him to make for it and would then draw down on him while he was exposed. For the same reason, he wouldn't imagine that she would go near it. Moving anywhere was tricky, because the ground lay strewn with dead leaves that announced her when she stepped on them, and with loose stones that would clatter out from underfoot. The big man's silence suggested that patience was one of his virtues. Evidently, he was content to wait her out. She couldn't afford patience. If he had called for backup, a small army of these Arcadian creeps might be en route. She put her back to the tree again and thought about the Range Rover and the dark slope beyond it. She looked downhill to study the frequency of trees and patted her sport coat pockets to check where everything was stowed. She holstered her pistol and sat on the ground and quietly removed her sneakers and pulled off her socks and slipped her bare feet into the shoes and tied the laces tight. With her switchblade, she cut a hole in the ribbed top of one sock. Working quickly, she knotted the toes of the socks together, extracted one of her plastic zip ties from a coat pocket, freed it from the rubber band that kept it tightly coiled, put the zip tie through the hole she'd made, and cinched it tightly to that sock. She coiled the plastic once more and stuffed it, with the socks, down the front of her jeans. She got to her feet and stood with her back against the tree once more and took slow, deep breaths and tried to think of another plan. There wasn't one. Chapter 25. Egon Gottfrey and his crew of eight descend on Longren Stables in five vehicles, fast along the approach lane, clouds of dust roiling in their wake as if they have ignited a prairie fire. This once failed property is now a thriving horse breeding business built on sweat equity, producing standard breds for harness racing, show quality Tennessee walking horses, and the National Show Horse, a breed that combines the Arabian and the American saddlebred. Gottfrey doesn't care about the Longrins' hard work, or about the beauty of the horses, or about the dust that shrouds him and his crew as they slide to a stop in the receiving yard and pile out of their vehicles, a few of them sneezing. He cares only about discerning what the unknown playwright's script requires of him next. He's pretty sure they're here to find Ansel and Claire Hawk at any cost, and they must knock heads and break knees if necessary. They are not wearing Kevlar because the law-abiding Longrins aren't likely to instigate violence. Each of them wears a hands-free earpiece walkie-talkie, and each knows what he or she needs to do. The last vehicle in the procession, the Cadillac Escalade driven by Paloma Sutherland, parks across the lane, barring exit. She and Sally Jones bail out and take up positions, pistols drawn. Chris Roberts and Janice Dern park at the Victorian-style house and move fast to mount the porch steps, he at the back, she at the front of the residence. She pounds hard on the door.
FBI! FBI!
Pedro and Alejandro set out to locate the stable hands and corral them in the fenced exercise yard outside Stable 5. Gottfrey, accompanied by Vince Penn and Rupert Baldwin, makes his way quickly to Stable 3, where Chase Longren has an office at one end of the building, opposite the tack room. Vince is sneezing, and Rupert is cursing between violent fits of coughing. Gottfrey keeps trying to spit out the taste of dust. The yellowish clouds drift with them. They aren't able to walk into fresh air. The persistent aggravation of the dust might make a lesser man than Gottfrey concede its reality. However, he's annoyed not with the dust, which is no more real than the stables, but with the unknown playwright who suddenly seems intent on furnishing the scene with more realistic detail than has lately been his style. When they enter Stable 3, with stalls to both sides and curious horses attendant to their visitors, the smells of manure and straw and horseflesh form a fragrance divine compared to the dust outside. They breathe deeply as they stride toward the end of the structure, and Gottfrey calls out,
Chase Longren? FBI. FBI, Mr. Longren.
Chase Longren, 6'2", sun-bleached hair, sun-bronzed face, stands at the desk in his office, facing the open door, his expression as hard as that of a defender of the Alamo. Entering the room, with Vince and Rupert close behind him, Godfrey says,
Egon Godfrey, FBI,
as he holds up his ID.
Yes, says Longren. So I heard. You sure did make a splashy entrance. Mr. J. Edgar Hoover would be proud. We have a warrant for the arrest of Ansel and Claire Hawk. You've got the wrong ranch. They live on the other side of Worsted, about 19 miles by the state route. They came here by horseback after 2 o'clock this morning. Before you deny that, Mr. Longren, I must advise you that it's a crime to lie to an FBI agent, even if you're not under oath.
Looking Rupert Baldwin up and down, Longren says,
Didn't the FBI used to have a dress code?
We found satellite video, infrared, that tracks them all the way from their place to yours,
Godfrey lies.
I'd like to see your warrant, Agent Godfrey.
The arrest warrant is for Ansel and Claire Hawk, not you.
I mean the warrant to search my property.
We are in active and urgent pursuit of suspects in a matter of national security, with reason to believe those we seek are on these premises. We're operating under a broad FISA court order. A post hoc copy of the warrant is the best you'll get.
Rupert Baldwin, pinch-faced perhaps because he's taken offense at the dress code remark, taps Godfrey on the shoulder. He draws his boss's attention to the computer screen on Longren's desk. The screen is quartered into 4 images, each a security camera view of part of the property, including the receiving yard where the dust has settled around the Rhino GX and other vehicles.
Mr. Longren, says Godfrey, keeping in mind it's a felony to lie to an FBI agent, where is your security system video archived? We need to review Ansel and Claire Hawk's arrival last night so that we can determine if, and in what vehicle, they left here.
Chapter 26. Ivan Petro, down on one knee behind a tree, maintaining a low profile, possessed of a Zen master's patience, passionate about the revolution, his fierce ambition fueled by bitter envy of those fools above him in the Arcadian ranks, smarter than them, able to quote long passages of Nietzsche and Weber and Freud word for word. In spite of his superior qualities and advantages, he wonders if he should call for assistance after all. Let others know that he has found Jane Hawk. He is uneasy when he recalls with what alacrity she escaped the 12-gauge taser. No, she's just a woman. A former FBI agent trained at Quantico, all right, but still, only a woman. Ivan is not one of those men who has no use for women. He has a use for them. One use, and he often uses them well, until they beg for surcease. He's not going to back away from this golden opportunity, not back away for backup. She is his ticket to the top. She belongs to him. She and her boy are his. He waits and listens. His left hand aches from the hammer blow, 2 skinned knuckles oozing a thin, bloody serum, fingers beginning to swell and grow stiff. His pistol is in his right hand. 20 feet east of him, Jane is betrayed by a clatter and prolonged rustle, loose stones and dry leaves sliding downhill. He turns toward the noise. Chapter 27. The live oaks were old, rooted in centuries, and most of their lowest limbs hung well above her head. The trick was to throw the stones hard and far, as high as possible to gain distance, but not so high that they were dropped short by an intervening limb. She stepped out from shelter, hoping he wasn't looking this way. She threw 1 stone, the second, grabbed the Taser XREP and plummeted downhill in long, wild strides, making some noise that perhaps was covered by whatever racket her 2 missiles produced. Fearful of a bullet, but exhilarated because action was better than paralysis. She passed 1 tree and skidded to a halt behind the next. A foot in front of her, an inpour of sunshine pooled on a drift of dead leaves. She stooped, and with her butane lighter, set the leaves ablaze. There was no danger of a catastrophic forest fire, only an isolated grove of 30 or 40 trees leafed through the glen. They were old, magnificent. It would be sad if they burned beyond recovery, but if she had to devastate the entire woodlet to save herself and her son, she would have no regret. She rose, pocketed the lighter, and drew her pistol. With Taser in her left hand and Heckler in her right, she moved fast through the shrouding gloom before the fire could flare bright enough to reveal her. Running, she squeezed off 4 rounds, counting on the reports and their echoes to cover what other sounds she made, aiming west at nothing so the muzzle flare wouldn't be evident to him where he waited to the east of her. The crack of gunfire echoed off the walls of the glen, off the trees, making it hard to determine from which direction the shots issued, encouraging him to believe that she'd spotted him and that he needed to keep his head down. At the foot of the slope, on the floor of the glen, Jane looked back and saw reflections of the flames fluttering among the trees, pulsing shadows interleaved with those wings of light. The blaze was already bright enough to draw her enemy's attention and distract him if he raised his head. She hurried east, avoiding shafts of incoming sunshine, glad that she was wearing dark colors, staying low as she raced toward the Range Rover, firing another 6 rounds to the west. Chapter 28. Somewhere east of Ivan Petro, the clatter of dislodged stones carries with it a rustling mass of dead oak leaves. He steps out from the tree where he's been sheltering and scans the shaded glen. In the direction from which the sound arose, the bosky murk is deep, pierced by a few thin golden stalks of sunlight, illuminating little, like the stems of radiant flowers that rise through the oak canopy to bloom out of sight above the trees. The crack of a pistol reminds him that Jane was at the top of her class in marksmanship at Quantico. He drops to the ground in a crackle of dried weeds, a disturbance of gnats swarming his nose and teasing from him a single, regretted sneeze. He lies flat through 3 more shots, the sounds ricocheting from glen wall to glen wall, the sound suppressed and diffused by the trees. After a silence, Ivan is about to lift his head to reconnoiter when she starts shooting again, 6 rounds in rapid succession. The large number of shots convinces him that he isn't the target, that she doesn't have a fix on his position. Supposing she prefers a pistol with a standard 10-round capacity, she has just emptied the magazine without a target in sight, which means her purpose must be to keep his head down while she moves from one place to another. She has spare magazines. Spare magazines and a plan. As he rises to his knees, his attention is drawn at once to the fire. 50 or 60 feet to the west, midway between the bottom of the glen and its north rim, a low, bright riffle of flames spreads not because of a breeze, for the air is still, but because it feeds on the rich fuel of dead leaves and weeds. Suddenly, the fire leaps as high as 2 feet, flailing the nearby trees with orange light, and a snake of pale smoke uncoils like a cobra swaying to a flute. This is a distraction, just as were the 10 shots she fired, just as were the rattling stones and the slithering leaf slide that had for a moment drawn his attention eastward. Distraction from what? Chapter 29. At the bottom of the glen, Jane crouched on the south side of the Range Rover, screened from her adversary, wherever he might be on the north slope. She put down the Taser XREP. She ejected the depleted magazine from the Heckler and snapped a fresh one into place and holstered the gun. Success now depended on speed, disconcerting the big man with another development while he was still trying to decide what to make of the first fire and the gunshots, before he committed to some course of action that she didn't want him to take. She flipped open the small port on the rear quarter panel of the Rover and twisted the cap off the fuel tank. She withdrew the knotted socks from the front of her jeans and stuffed them into the gas tank filler neck, using the stiff plastic zip tie to work them into the tank itself. When the gasoline began to travel by exosmosis through the socks, she could smell the fumes swelling in strength. She waited until the fabric ought to be saturated. Gripping the dry end of the stiff plastic zip tie, she pulled the makeshift torch out of the tank, being careful to avoid dripping fuel on herself, taking care not to get any whatsoever on her right hand. Shut the tank cap. Closed the flip door. Turning away from the rover, she peered into the darkest portion of the glen, the nearby section of the south slope leading upward under a dense thatching of limbs and leaves. The land seemed less steep here than on the north wall of the glen, but the footing could still be treacherous. With the rim of the glen defined by a narrow, ragged band of light far ahead, with blackness close on all sides, she ascended, dangling the dripping mass of cotton socks at arm's length to her left side. There seemed to be no grass or weeds here where the sun seldom penetrated. Oak tree sheddings crunched underfoot, but she thought her would-be captor must be too far away to hear. Although surface roots caused her to stumble, she kept her balance, quickly venturing 40 or 50 feet. She dropped the fuel-sodden socks in dry leaves and retreated 10 feet, and with her right hand touched the butane flame to yet more leaves downslope from the crude incendiary device. When this new fuel kindled, before the light could swell bright enough to reveal her, she hurried to the rover and crouched there once more. She watched this second fire quicken low, and at first fitfully, until it found the drizzle of gasoline that she had left when making her way up the hill, whereupon it flared into a bright zipper and sizzled directly to the source. Flames leaped high, like a demonic manifestation, and fell back, but then surged again, bits of burning leaves spiraling up on rising thermals, carried into darkness where they quivered like a swarm of fireflies. She looked west, and saw that the first fire was spreading toward the north rim, but also downhill toward the floor of the glen, not yet climbing into the trees, though some limbs were festooned with smoke-like beards of Spanish moss. He was patient, certain that if he hunkered down and waited, she would make a mistake and reveal herself. His patience had given her time to upend the situation, rattle his expectations. He was a very big man. And big men in his line of work tended to be overconfident, to have an unconscious belief that they were all but invincible. Some also had a tendency to conflate strength with wit, attributing to themselves greater intelligence and cunning than they possessed. If he was one such, he would be frustrated by his failure to rise in the ranks to a position he thought commensurate with his value to the cause. She had seen such men in the FBI and elsewhere. This frustration would explain why, once he found her, he had come after her alone instead of waiting for backup, as any clear-thinking Arcadian would have done. She was the prize of prizes, the cure for his frustration, and he must be loath to share the credit for her capture. When she'd thwarted the taser attack, especially if the hammer injured him, his confidence would have been rattled. Now, within a few minutes, she'd moved aggressively through the shadows, shooting 10 rounds and setting 2 fires, counting on chaos to unsettle him further. When a man who rarely entertained much self-doubt began to wonder if he might be vulnerable after all, then what virtues he possessed, such as patience, frequently deserted him. Fire could create its own draft. The heat from this second blaze drew toward it the cool air in the glen, a breeze that hugged the ground and chased the flames toward the top of the slope. But there were countercurrents, and when flaming debris was cast high enough by the lower draft, it was spun back into this little valley, some of it descending as harmless ashes, some still burning when it fell upon combustible material. Maybe she'd misjudged him. Maybe the chaos she'd sown would grow out of control and consume her with him. Maybe playing with fire, as she had been doing for many weeks, figuratively and now literally, had drawn the devil to her or she to him, and this was now the fire of her final judgment. She wriggled under the Range Rover. Chapter 30. At the Longren House. Janice Dern's insistent knocking and loud proclamation of her status as FBI bring to the door a freckle-faced girl of about 12,
a tomboy type in sneakers and worn blue jeans and a t-shirt emblazoned with the words Semper Fi. The kid says,
"Good gracious, lady, we're not deaf."
"Who are you?" Janice demands.
"Lori Longren. If you'd like to have a seat on the porch, I can bring you some iced tea or lemonade, whichever you prefer."
"Where's your mother? Your father?"
"Dad's over in his office at Stable 3. Mom is out in the potato patch, planting seeds."
"Where would that be?"
The girl gestures more or less northwest, then steps across the threshold, pulls the door shut, and squeezes past Janice.
"Come on, I'll show you the way."
Janice is the youngest of four sisters. As a consequence of that experience, she has determined never to have children, and, in fact, never to trust a child. She says,
Hey, wait a second,
halting Lori at the porch steps.
"This isn't a farm. It's a horse breeding operation."
"We're versatile," Lori says. "We make horses and potatoes. Carrots, too. Onions and radishes. And we sew really nice quilts."
"I know your type," Janice says. "You're a conniving little shit, aren't you?"
Before the girl can respond, Janice turns to the door, opens it, shouts,
"FBI! FBI!"
and enters the house. The noxious child forces her way past Janice into the foyer, sees Chris Roberts following the hall forward from the kitchen, and sprints up the stairs.
"Here they come, Mom, and they aren't the freaking FBI!"
Janice races after the kid, reaches the top of the stairs in time to see her disappear into a room near the end of the hall. A door slams. By the time Janice gets there, the door is locked. If she were an FBI agent in reality, and not just on paper, this situation would present Janice Dern with a problem regarding illegal searches and seizures. However, because she's in no danger of having to answer to anyone at the Bureau or Homeland, only to her techno-Arcadian superiors, who expect results by any means necessary, she draws her pistol and kicks the door hard and kicks it again. There is no deadbolt, only a simple privacy latch, which comes apart on the second kick, and the door rackets open. Pistol in both hands, though expecting no serious resistance, let alone a firefight, Janice enters the room low and so fast that the rebounding door misses her. A home office. Lori to the left, looking too damn pleased with herself. Devious little bitch. Her mother, Alexis, sitting at the desk, working so intently on a computer that she doesn't even look up when the door crashes open.
"What are you doing?" Janice demands of the mother. "Get away from the computer!"
Chris Roberts crosses the room in a few long strides, seizes the wheeled office chair, and shoves the woman away from the desk.
"Too late!"
cries the infuriating brat. In Chase Longren's office in Stable 3, a sudden tumult issues from the speaker in the 12-line phone on the desk, followed by Janice Dern's voice.
"What are you doing? Get away from the computer!"
Egon Gottfried hadn't previously noticed the red indicator light glowing above the word intercom. As they had arrived in the stable and announced themselves before they even found this office, Longren must have opened a line between here and somewhere in the house. A young girl's voice comes over the intercom.
"Too late!"
Godfrey looks up at Chase Longren, who is smiling. Studying the computer screen, Chris Roberts says,
"I think she just deleted the security system video archives."
Ansel and Claire Hawk came here in the night, on horseback, and they left in one vehicle or another, which would have been captured by the security cameras. Janice looms over the smug child, glaring down at her, wanting to grab a fistful of her hair and pull hard and knock her down.
"I know your type. Oh, I know your type, you smart-ass little puke."
Undaunted, the girl says,
"What kind of numbnuts would believe potatoes grow from seeds?"
Raising the pistol as if to slash the barrel across Lori's face, Janice doesn't intend to strike the girl, only to scare the exasperating, self-satisfied look off that freckled countenance. It's a patented Francine look, exactly like Janice's sister, Francine. The mother pulls a gun from under her chair and fires around into the ceiling, bringing down a rain of plaster chips. Janice pivots toward the mother, and here they are, each with a pistol in a two-hand grip, each a trigger pull away from blood and maybe death.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! Nobody wants this, says Chris, having been careful not to draw his weapon. Maybe I want this,
Janice disagrees.
This isn't like you, Chris says. What's got you so pissed? Little Miss Semper Fi, this ugly, freckled gash, thinks the rules don't apply to her.
I'm not ugly, the girl declares. I know that for a fact.
It's you, the mother accuses Janice, who thinks the rules don't apply to her. You and these other bastards. Get out of my house.
It's our house, Janice says, until we give it back to you.
Chris Roberts needs 2 tense minutes to negotiate an end to the standoff in Alexis Longren's home office. Chapter 31. Near the top of the north slope, Ivan Petro stands in shadow, watching firelight colonize the darkness, the thin smoke growing thicker. The acrid scent burns in his nostrils. He now knows the meaning of disquiet as never before. He has long taken pride in being above all fear, being the bearer of fear who brings it to others. Being a learned man, even although self-taught, he can define disquiet, the mildest state of fear, a general uneasiness threaded with doubt. Knowing the definition and being gripped by disquiet are, however, different things, for in fact, those threads of doubt are more like wires vibrating in his veins. There are some in the revolution who embrace a disturbing explanation for why Jane Hawke is so elusive and so successful at bringing down everyone she targets. They think it's not just her bureau training and her natural talents that make her a singular threat. They say she is also empowered by insanity, a special kind of mad rage because of her husband's murder and the threat to her child. Some serial killers carve their way through a long list of victims, active for years before being apprehended, because their madness is strangely coupled with reason rather than being divorced from it. And they have as well a heightened sense of intuition, so that they not only think outside the box, but also outside the box that the first box came in. Ivan has thought this insane Jane explanation is fanciful at best, but in truth, ridiculous. He has secretly scorned those who find the idea compelling. He's no longer sure what to think of her, though at the moment, no theory exists that he would scorn. There is no way to spot her in this shadowed valley where spreading fire dances and, in its dancing, throws off 1,000 phantom figures of shadow, light, and smoke. Its many voices, some sibilant, some full of croak and crackle, provide cover for any sounds she makes. His injured hand throbs, stiff and all but useless. The thin haze of smoke makes his eyes itch and water. Although he is standing still, he finds himself breathing as fast as if he were running. The Range Rover is not at this moment threatened by the blaze, but suddenly he is sure that her intention is to disable it so he can't drive out of the woods. She means to strand him and then stalk him through the bewildering, shifting shapes of fire and shadow. He is a man of reason. Self-taught but highly learned, a man who lives by facts and numbers and sharp calculations, with a seldom exercised imagination, with no taste for fantasy in literature or films. He is likewise proudly free of all superstition. Brains and brute strength are all he's ever needed. Yet, a previously unknown sensation crawls his spine, prickles his nerves, and in spite of the growing heat in the glen, a coldness arises within his chest. Furious that some primitive belief in the uncanny is embedded in him and waiting for the right circumstances to conjure it, Ivan is determined to repress it and assert himself as a man of reason, fearless action, and unstoppable force. There are 2 threats to the Range Rover, the spreading fire and the woman who set the fire. If he must kill her rather than capture her in order to drive the vehicle out of the glen before the fire consumes it, then he will.
And when he presents Jane Hawk's bloody, broken body to his smug superiors, maybe he'll shoot them, too, if they don't promote him as he has long deserved. Pistol in his right hand, arms straight out in front of him, he strides down the shadowed slope, as fearless as a Terminator robot from the future, turning his head left and right, scanning the woods for a target, periodically glancing back, moving fast because she would expect him to come slowly, if he came at all. Chapter 32. Such was the clearance under the Range Rover that Jane had to lie with her head turned to the side, one cheek flat to the earth. He might assume that she had taken up a position on the level bottom of the glen, behind one tree or another, where shadows hadn't been faded by firelight. Or he might think she'd gotten into the Rover, intending to ambush him as he reached to open the driver's door. She didn't believe he would give any credit to the possibility that she was lying concealed under the vehicle. For one thing, because of his size, he could never squirm beneath the SUV, and so he'd assume that the space wouldn't accommodate her either. In chaotic moments, a hunter of people had a strong tendency to calculate the options available to his target based on his own limitations if he'd been the hunted one. Furthermore, it seemed reckless of her to commit herself to such a confining space. Given her reputation and her success taking down people at the top of the conspiracy, he wouldn't expect her to be so imprudent. What seemed like a rash act to a man like him, however, was simple necessity to a mother whose child remained a couple hundred miles away, in peril, and arguably the second most wanted fugitive in America. If she'd meant to kill the man, she would have done this a different way, but there were questions for which she urgently needed answers. With bright appetite, the second fire grazed across the south slope, hungry but not yet ravenous. Unless a stronger breeze sprang up, the flames weren't likely to reach the Rover before Jane's quarry appeared. Most of the smoke rose through the trees, drawn toward cooler air, but a thin haze drifted under the Rover. Although the growing conflagration had many voices, the cover it would give her when she moved wasn't sufficient to mask a cough. She breathed into the crook of her elbow, the sleeve of her sport coat against her nose, peering over her forearm at the floor of the glen where, perhaps, the big man would appear. She cursed him, silently, willed him to arrive, commanded his attendance, as if she had the power over him that he would have over the adjusted people who had been injected with nanomechanisms, prayed for his deliverance into her hands. Suddenly, there he was, visible to her only from the ankles down, evidently committed to boldness, moving fast, heading directly for the Range Rover. Then he did something she had not expected. Chapter 33. Less than 5 minutes since the first fire flared, but in that brief time, this transformation from Thoreau to Poe, from a tranquil sylvan retreat into a Halloween night scene. The previously noble trees now grotesque black shapes, backdropped by veins of fire that bleed out in a steadily greater flood. Ivan Petro has nothing to gain by caution. The glen is a stage, and the bitch controls it as if she's both author and director. She has set the scene, designed the visuals, put the Rover in the center of the proscenium arch, and she's given him only one entrance to the play. Down the path he's taken, and straight to the driver's door. If she hasn't used these distractions to flee, if she's watching, she sees him approach and chooses to let him get closer to the vehicle. Every ancient moss-mottled tree trunk offers an assassin cover, and Ivan worries that the bitch might even have climbed into one of these long-enduring oaks to lie upon a sturdy limb and stare down at him through a filigree of leaves. He has been transformed no less than has the glen. He can smell his own sour sweat, and his stomach feels as if a knot has been tied in it. For the first time in maybe 18 years, since he repaid his father's violence with some of his own and freed himself from the hell that is family, he suffers a surge of acid reflux so strong that a bitter taste arises in the back of his mouth. If the bitch is hiding in the Rover, she isn't in the cargo area, because even lying flat in that space, she'd be only an inch or two below the windows, too easily seen. She isn't in the front seat, either, because there would be too many obstacles in her way. Steering wheel, pedals, console, nowhere to get low except in the footwell that serves the passenger seat, where she would be too visible in spite of the darkness gathered in the vehicle. So if she's in there, she must be on the floor behind the front passenger seat, with her back pressed to the door, her feet braced against the transmission hump, her gun in a two-hand grip, waiting for him to appear, firelit, in one of the side windows. If she's crouched against the farther flank of the vehicle, rather than inside it, that's all right, too, because what he's about to do is likely to move her to act, and by acting, make a target of herself. Approaching the driver's side, before there's a chance she can see him from in there, he squeezes off three quick shots, shattering the window into the rear seat, blowing out the window on the farther side. He's a little jumpy, and in pain, and totally pissed off, so one round is off the mark and shatters the glass in the driver's door. If she's in there, she should have been startled into returning fire. Nor does she rise from the farther side of the Rover to cut him down. Ivan scans the witchy trees, the shadowy north slope, the south slope, beribboned with fire, but there is no sign of her. Expecting a bullet in the back of the head or straight on in the face, using his throbbing left hand, he fumbles with the handle and opens the driver's door. The interior light comes on. He can see into both the front and back seats, and Jane isn't in either. He sits behind the wheel and, wincing in pain, pulls the door shut. All it's about now is getting out of here faster than fast. The electronic key is in his pocket. The Range Rover has a push-button ignition. He doesn't put down the pistol, but holds it ready, using his bad hand to start the engine. Borne off the sloped south wall of the glen, phantom snakes of smoke serpentine through the shot-out back window on the passenger side, and a fit of coughing racks Ivan. For a moment, he forgets how to release the emergency brake, fumbling for a lever that he recalls from a previous vehicle. Fire is seething close on the south slope. Burning debris has ignited the layers of leaves on the floor of the glen directly ahead of him. Suddenly, he's more concerned about being trapped by fire than he is about Jane Hawk, which is a mistake. When he looks away from the south slope to remind himself where the brake release can be found, he is at once aware of a presence rising beyond the imploded window in the driver's door. It's her. She's got the Taser XREP 12 gauge. Before Ivan can bring his Colt 45 around and kill her, she fires point blank. The four electrodes on the nose of the cartridge hook the side of his bare neck, and the first charge, the localized charge, stings as though he's thrust his head into a wasp nest. He's aware of the pistol falling out of his hand. When the chassis separates from the nose of the Taser projectile, he doesn't grasp the wire by which it dangles, but then a second set of longer electrodes deploys. He's slammed by the primary charge, vision dazzled into brief blindness by internal fireworks as colorful as any Independence Day display, his teeth chattering until his jaws lock, pain coursing from his scalp to the soles of his feet, every fascicle of nerve fibers short-circuiting. Paralysis. Chapter 34. For a moment, Ivan Petro is a child again, shaking with pain, cowering in the shadow of his father, gagging on the refluxed acid that burns up his throat and forms a bitter pool in his mouth, as it had so often during those years lived in nervous expectation of the old man's violence. Ivan is too weak to run, too confused to hide, clenching his jaws to keep from expressing the raw ferocity of his hatred, which will only earn him